Author Richard Peck's book, A Long Way from Chicago, was the 2010 book selection for the Springfield Greene County Library's Big Read Celebration in April 2010. To cap the month, the author himself visited the library on April 29th and 30th for receptions, book signings, and a humorous talk for a crowd of eager listeners. Peck began by explaining that A Long Way from Chicago began as a short story called Shotgun Cheatham's Last Night Above Ground, which he wrote for a collection of gun stories called 12 Shots. When his book editor at Dial Press read the short story, she told him to keep writing and turn it into a collection of short stories to build into a novel. And so, he just kept writing. What follows is Peck's talk on April 30th at the Library Center in Springfield for about 100 youngsters and adults.
That story set off a chain of events in my life. I wrote it as a short story first, and then a book, and then a sequel, and then another. It set off a magic chain that took me to the Kremlin for the Russian National Book Festival. It took me to dinner at the White House with President and Mrs. Bush. It took me places I never dreamed of going, couldn't have gone otherwise. But best of all, it brought me here to these young readers. And to Mrs. Sellers' young writers, whom I spent the morning with, sixth graders who are already well along on the way to realizing that nothing is real until it's written down. I've met the best of teaching in Springfield and the best of acting. I come to you from New York City, where I live, to keep my eye on the publisher. They have short attention spans and no geography. I'm sorry to tell you, they don't know where Springfield is. But I have to. I want readers everywhere, and they don't know where I go. And when I come back full of my experiences, they want to tell me what I missed while I was away. But I didn't come from New York to begin with, never think it. I came from a town that was founded in 1829 and had 57,000 people in it in 1935. No, it wasn't Springfield. It was Decatur, Illinois, a town just like Springfield, where it took the whole town to keep a secret. And in that town, I had three dreams as a kid. To be a writer. To work at a desk at a window high up looking out over the electric skyline of New York City. And my third dream, to go everywhere and meet everybody. You want to be very careful what you wish for. I got everything I ever dreamed of because of the power and the passion and the potential and the poetry of the American English language. Before it fell. It took me everywhere. And everywhere I went, I have gone with a boy from Missouri. I met him in fourth grade, and he changed my life. I didn't meet him in class. I wouldn't have sat next to him in class. I met him in the library. And he's with me always. I can hear his voice now. Here it is. In the morning, we went up to the village and bought a wire rat trap and fetched it down and unstopped the best rat hole. And in about an hour, we had 15 of the bulliest kind of ones. And then we took it and put it in a safe place under Aunt Sally's bed. But while we was gone for spiders, little Thomas Franklin Benjamin Jefferson Alexander Phelps found it there and opened the door of it to see if the rats would come out. And they would. And Aunt Sally, she come in. And when we got back, she's standing on top of the bed, raising Cain. And the rats was doing what they could to keep off the dull times for her. So she dusted us both with the hickory stick. And we was as much as 2 hours catching another 15 or 16. And we got a splendid stock of assorted spiders and bugs and frogs and caterpillars and one thing and another. And we liked to get a hornet's nest, but we didn't. The family was at home. That's why I'm here tonight. Because of Huckleberry Finn, a Missouri boy, written by a Missouri man, Mark Twain, who became my hero, and is still my hero, because he could make rough poetry out of real speech, and because he could make high drama and high comedy about the kind of people who live right next door. He lit up my life. The minute I read those lines, I wanted that. I've never stopped wanting it. I can't be Mark Twain. But we write in admiration of better writers than we are. And you have to read 1,000 books before you can write one. And because we write by the light of every book we ever read, or was read to us when we were very small. And one more thing that Mark Twain did for me. He taught me a secret, that humor is anger that was sent to finishing school. That's why I'm here tonight. We all need our role models, writers or not. And all the best role models are dead. And all the worst role models are a year ahead of you in school. I'm a writer and with you tonight because in fourth grade I could read a 19th century novel cover to cover. Not because I was gifted, but because my teachers, teachers with 40 students in every room, my teachers had the full authority of their classrooms. A vanished tribe of teachers that prove a sacred truth, that you can teach children or you can fear their parents, but you can't do both. And I could read a 19th century novel in fourth grade because I'd gotten a head start. I marched into kindergarten on the day Hitler marched into Poland. But I was better prepared than he. I'd had a mother who read to me. This evening proceeded apace. Light the lamp and turn the page and be oh, any place. Pirates there were and palaces and a raft at the river's bend. I warmed my face at the story's light, hoping it wouldn't end. I had a mother who read to me. As the afternoon ebbed away, and stories stirred in the darkening wood. And that's why I'm here today. Because most of who we are is decided in those first 5 fleeting years of life before we ever see school. Schools don't build foundations. Schools build upon foundations. And when schools fail, families failed first. Today we're told there's no time to read to a child in the single-parent family. In the family where both parents work, no schedule for reading in the Wi-Fi online family where Facebook glows hot into the night long after parents are fast asleep. We're told there's no patience to read to the hyperactive child. I wanted to be hyperactive too, but mother wouldn't let me. And so I am with you tonight. Every writer who ever appears in front of you will tell you that something else made them a writer, a teacher. There's always a teacher who did it. And never a college teacher. We get to them too late in our lives, and often in theirs. No, the teacher that brought me here today was named Miss Franklin, and she taught English down at the high school. She taught senior year English to the college bound. So if you aspired to college, there was no way around her. There were almost no electives in senior year in my high school, which is good. Senior year is the worst time in life for electives. But there was nothing elective about Miss Franklin. And how well I remember that first day of senior year English all those Septembers ago. It's engraved upon my heart. When Miss Franklin walked into the room, looked us over, and spoke these memorable words. I can get every one of you in this room into the colleges of your choices. or I can keep you out. Now that's teaching. But I had more to learn from Miss Franklin. I had fallen into bad habits as a student. I had grown accustomed to receiving A's on my English compositions. And A's, as we now know from the sad experience of our children, are the end of education, not the beginning. Nobody ever learned anything from an A. But when I got my first paper back from Miss Franklin, there was no grade on it at all. Instead, there were words written across the page. I see them clearly still, in red ink. Those words were these: never express yourself again on my time. Find a more interesting topic. Well, I was 17. I didn't know what a more interesting topic than me would be. I actually went to the woman and said, what would a more interesting topic be? And she said, almost anything. That led me to the library, a place I had successfully avoided up till then, in search of subject matter that was not me. All these years later, in another century, I'm still in the library looking for information that is not me. Because a story is always about something that never happened to the author. J.K. Rowling did not attend Hogwarts School. Beatrix Potter was never a rabbit. Stephanie Meyer was never bitten by a you-know-what. We write not from experience, but from observation. We write not from recollection, but from research. I do not remember the 1930s, please believe me. But it's there in the library. And now, I own it. Because everybody owns the information they get in the library. And one more reason, I am a writer. Most people have to be something else on their ways to being writers. I had to be a teacher. I was a teacher once, as you can tell by looking. An English teacher, of course, what else is there? Because if you cannot read appreciatively and write coherently and speak persuasively and listen skeptically, you will find a way to fail at whatever you want. Nothing is real until it's written down. I was a teacher back in the days when, before they ran the Latin teacher out of town. And in the absence of the Latin teacher, there was so little English left to be taught, we had to call it language arts, which is apparently English without homework or grammar. But I was a teacher, and my students made a writer out of me. And here's how it happened. I had come from college teaching, and so they gave me the senior year English teachers, the students, at the AP to get them ready for all the right colleges. And I had my tenure, too. And I was making a life out of that. Of course, it wasn't my dream, but it was a living. And then one day, I got the shock of my life. Somebody pulled the world out from under me. I see it now in every one of my novels. Every one of my novels is based on the idea that we learn the most from the experience we would have avoided if we could. I thought I'd learned that early in life by being drafted, but it happened to me again. I was reassigned junior high. Nobody chooses to teach junior high. You get reassigned. And changing the name of the junior high to the middle school has fooled nobody. It's still puberty. Puberty is the darkest time of life. For while it is the death of childhood, it is not the birth of reason. I looked around one awful Monday morning, and I was the only one in the room not going through puberty. It gets worse. It was a girls' school. So I was the only one in the room who did not want my mother dead. I'm not done. It was a school for the academically gifted. Yes, so I was the only one in the room who was not gifted. And now we hit bottom. It was just off Park Avenue in New York City. So I was the only one in the room without a full line of credit. And nothing I had ever taught was going to work with these people. They were too old for the literature of childhood and too young for anything else. You see where I'm going, don't you? I became a writer only after I had found the people I hoped to write for. And they were nothing like me. I remember no puberty like theirs. I had never gone through any of that. And I had never had those freedoms at that age. They might have destroyed me too. And so, I wasn't ready to write. You're never ready to write until you have found the people who might want to read what you might be able to write. And my students taught me how to write. First of all, they kicked the living autobiography out of me. They heard all of those stories about being young long ago in olden times from their parents, and they didn't believe any of that could have happened in a free country. So I knew a story. I learned from seventh graders that a story must be about the reader, not the writer, that nobody is waiting to hear about your life story. And so many young people, of course, think they must write their life story and that the world is waiting to hear. The world isn't, and they won't get them published. But I didn't have to go through that because my students spared me. And another thing, my students introduced me to first person. Always tell the story in the voice of a young character, never your own voice. You have the wrong vocabulary. You have the wrong memories. But there at the lonely front of the classroom, I learned how long they would listen to my voice and how much longer they would listen to each other's. Oh, what a treasure that was to learn. I knew never to appear in my stories, never let myself show. Always find a young person to tell the story. And with that, I quit my teaching job. Nothing I had believed in teaching survived the revolutions of the late 60s and early 70s. Because politics is not only the enemy of art, politics is the enemy of education. And so I had to quit in order to communicate with the young. And I did. I quit one day. I turned in my regular salary and my pension plan and my hospitalization and my tenure. And I turned in my attendance book, which was my first work of fiction. And I went home to write or die. But that's the only way you can do it. You write by the light of the bridges burning behind you. If I could have gone out to do something else, I would have. But I went home to write a novel, and that was 38 years and 38 books ago. We always have less to lose than we think. But where did it all come from? Writing is the skill of listening. And when I was young, I was surrounded by old people. And it was in an era in which adults ruled the world. And so I was trying to pick up on what they were saying. I was trying to learn a vocabulary to negotiate with them. And I wanted to hear their stories. It seemed to me I had been here such a short time and they'd been here so long. And so I sat as a kid, not a very normal kid, I sat among the old men who hung out on the pump island of my dad's Phillips 66 filling station, gas station. And they talked about the old days. They had detachable collars. And mustaches left over from the 90s, and they'd get confused about time. They'd say, here a while back, and they were talking about the 19th century. I was like, oh, good. They talked about the great adventure of their life, going all the way to Chicago to ride the great wheel at the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893. And so when I was an old man myself, I had to write a story called Fair Weather. Not because I'd gotten to ride the great wheel, but because I hadn't. Because a story is always about something that never happened to me. I sat, and to tell you the truth, my favorite stories were not the ones my mother was reading to me, nor the ones by Mark Twain. My very favorite stories were the stories adults were telling each other and then stopped when a kid came in the room. I've spent the rest of my life trying to find the endings of those stories. It's what we don't know that makes us right. And so, I don't remember the Depression, but I remember the war, World War II. Does anybody remember World War II? Yes, well. I was a grade school kid in those days, in an era in which every kid was expected to do his part. So the theme of our childhood was war, but the theme of our parents' conversation was the golden age before the war, before the shortages, before Meatless Tuesday, before the draft and the boys were away. Before the war, they said you could just go out and buy a car. You could buy tires. You could buy bananas. You could get chocolate. Sugar wasn't rationed. And the boys were home. It was years before I realized they were nostalgic about the Great Depression. Had it looked that good at the time? Oh no. But nostalgia is an art form. And before I figured out that I was in love with the past. And that brings me to the other end of life when I wanted to create the Great Depression with humor, with grapes of mirth. And I looked up one day, and there standing in the door of my study was the biggest woman you ever saw, in a Lane Bryant dress and an apron the size of Alaska with Rick Rack. Does anybody remember Rick Rack? I think probably Springfield was the kind of place where Rick Rack came to die. I feel so at home here. There she was, the biggest, toughest woman in town and heavily armed. She was the 1930s, but I knew her at once. She was all my great aunts. Rolled up into one big package. All my long-gone great aunts with fine names. Pearl, Maud, Mildred, Geneva, Cora. Not a Brittany among them. Farm women who ruled the universe from black iron stoves in kitchens hot enough to peel the calendars off the walls. Women in vast Cuban-heeled lace-up shoes who had grown larger and larger with time as their husbands grew smaller and smaller and then finally vanished entirely. A race of mighty women who left the small boy I was in no doubt about who ruled. Women as strong as young people want adults to be if they can find them. And here is Grandma Dowd, as you read it, told by her grandson Joey. She kept a 12-gauge double-barreled Winchester Model 21 behind the woodbox, but we figured it must have been Grandpa Dowdle's for shooting ducks. Oh, I don't think so. She's heavily armed and trigger happy. She's my kind of woman. And she has a secret, doesn't she? She lives for the sight of those grandkids. She's just not going to let them know until the end. That book won the Newbery Silver Medal, A Long Way from Chicago. And suddenly my life began to change, and I suddenly was under the influence of a woman who didn't really exist, except got more mail than I did. And when your book wins the silver medal, Newbery Medal, what does your editor say to you?
What?
Write a sequel.
And we'll read it by? Thursday. Well, I had made a mistake in that first book. It's quite clear at the end. I'd let Joey grow up. He wants to fly, so I arranged for World War II. And he goes to flight school and becomes a pilot. I gave him his dream, and he walked away from me. But he had a little sister. You remember Mary Alice? All she wants to be is Shirley Temple. But I asked her to come and see me. You can do that. And she said, what do you want? And I said, I have to do a sequel, and you're all I've got left. You want to be in it? And she said, maybe I want to be in it, and maybe I don't want to be in it. I'm sick to death of being a kid. Make me 15. Well, I'm a teacher. I can compromise. I said, you're 15. And there she stood, somewhat taller in the room. And it was 1937, because in the first book, she'd been born in 1922. There were already rules. And so I did what you do. I bought a blank paper, and I moved into the library, because I needed to know everything that happened in 1937 to get the ideas. Most of what happened in 1937 was not going to work in a book about a woman living in a little town, but I had to know everything that went on to find it. And so I made a timeline from the Bound Galleys, about bound volumes of Time magazine. You don't want to read history books, because they're by people who know what's going to happen. You want to read about people who don't know what's going to happen. In 1937, they didn't know what was going on, what was just around the corner, just as we do not know. And so I made a timeline. In the summer of 1937, for example, the most famous woman in America vanished without a trace. Well, you have to mention her, but you mustn't let her take over, because that's another story. But you have to mention what people were talking about. But I wasn't finding my story. It wasn't Amelia. It wasn't what was going on in Europe yet. And then in Time magazine in September, I opened a page, and there it was. Something called the Roosevelt Recession. Another market crash that wiped out all of the gains in the New Deal. I staggered back. There it was. There it was. Mary Alice's parents would lose their apartment in Chicago. They'd have to go into rooms, and she'd have to go live with Grandma. That turned up the heat, you see. That wasn't a vacation with her brother. That was all by herself. Going to that little town and living with Grandma, going to that school. And anybody who thinks small towns are friendly lives in a big city. And if I had not done the timeline from Time magazine, I wouldn't have known about the Roosevelt Recession. We have a literature of the 1929 market crash of Hoovervilles, a literature. Where is the information on the Roosevelt Recession? Not in the history textbooks. Because history textbooks are written by Democrats. So you go around and you go back to Time magazine, because they don't know what's happening next, and neither do your characters. And so there in the library I found the book that won the Newbery Gold Medal. Those sequels never win. They did. And then Grandma fell silent for years. She'd run out of grandchildren. And she'd been good to me. I didn't want to beat her to death. But in over 8 years, the letters keep coming from young people. And I write from the letters and the lives of my readers, not me. And so finally I was pushed over the edge to write a third book called A Season of Gifts. I did what you have to do. I read the first two books again to see if there were any holes in them that I could fill with the third novel. That was a great big hole. in two books I had never mentioned who might live next door, who might live, have the dubious advantage of living next door to that woman. I looked closer, and it was the autumn of 1958, and moving in next door was the new Methodist minister and his children, preacher's kids. The Methodist minister sent by the conference to start a new church from scratch in a town of 300 people that already has 11 churches. These people are going to need some help. And they don't see help is at hand next door, swatting Fuller brushmen off her porch with a broom. And it's 1958. Because I built it around a cultural experience of, in October 1958, what was the great pop culture incident of October 1958? Elvis is stationed overseas, Germany, by the army. And every teenage girl in America goes into mourning. Oh, I have to use that. I have to make sure one of those preacher's kids is a 14-year-old girl who's going to need a lot of help. But the story is told by a boy who's in sixth grade, undersized, the preacher's kid, and has to start a new school in a new town. You always throw your characters into the deep end to see if they will sink or swim. We are not the gifted program. And so, he's going to need some help, and he'll get help. But oh my, it's hard at the beginning. There's a gang in the town, an awful mean gang, and their leader is 20 years old, and the worst thing I could think of to make him, an Elvis impersonator. Oh, am I going to the end?
We're going to try and catch you.
She's robbed me of my high moment. Thank you. I thought she was telling me my time was up. Well, in a sense, she was. See, you can't make this stuff up. To greet this boy, the preacher's son, Bob, the gang kidnaps him, ties him hand and foot, duct tapes his mouth, half drowns him in the creek, and then carries him back, stark naked, to hang him up by ropes in the privy of the scariest old lady in town. Then they were gone. I was alone. The smell in here was truly bad. I swayed in my web of ropes and tried to take a positive view of the situation. I couldn't. For one thing, my knees were higher than my ears. My feet were sound asleep. Then suddenly the privy door banged open. Filling the door and then some was Mrs. Dowdle. A copy of the Farm Journal and three corn cobs were in one of her fingers. Her specs crept to the end of her nose. We were nose to nose. All she wanted to do was use her privy, and here I was barring her way, naked as a jaybird in my own personal web. Well, I'll be a ring-tailed monkey if that don't about take the cake, she said. I thought I'd seen everything. I made a small sound. She dumped her corn cobs in the Farm Journal and ripped the duct tape off my mouth. Ow! Had to be done. She said, who did you say you was? I coughed up something, maybe a tadpole from the creek. I'm Bob Barnhart, the boy next door. Well, said Mrs. Dunn, I see you ain't the girl. From this unpromising beginning, their relationships unfold. I'm a writer because my mother read to me, and I came from a town like this, where I learned very early that every journey in life begins in the library, and that your library card is your ticket out of town. It took me everywhere I wanted to be, including here this evening.